Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week's episode is a recording of a talk I gave at the conference of the Huddersfield Local History Society on the 5th of November. It looks at the role that Huddersfield as a town and a club played in the events which led to rugby's great split in 1895. It's a live recording, so as with all bootlegs, the sound quality is somewhat variable. I hope you enjoy it. What I wanted to do today is to ask why the famous meeting of the 29th of August 1895, which created Rugby League, which was then known as the Northern Union, the Northern Rugby Football Union, and split rugby into two separate games, was held here in Huddersfield. And to explore the broader question of Huddersfield's role in the cleaving of rugby along class lines and the upsurge of working class politics and organisation in the same period at the end of the 19th century. The first part of the question, why was the meeting held in Huddersfield, is actually very boring and easy to answer. It's because Huddersfield Railway Station is almost equidistant between Widnes in the west and Hull in the east, the two clubs at furthest apart that came together for that meeting. And as the meeting was held at 6:30 on a Thursday evening, it made great sense to meet here in Huddersfield. And in fact, as I'm sure you're aware, the geographical footprint of the sport remains pretty similar today. But rather than being linked by the rail network, Rugby League today is connected largely by the M62, with the exception of the two French clubs. So, unfortunately, there was no direct link between Huddersfield's radical traditions and the Rugby Rebellion of 1895. The fact that Huddersfield was chosen was in fact a tribute to the efficiency of the Victorian railway system, which, given my recent experiences with Northern Rail, I suspect it probably takes longer now to get from Hull to Huddersfield than what it did in 1895. That's not to say there were no stirrings of the town's radical traditions involved in the rugby split. George Harrop, who was a local referee and was also a member of the Huddersfield Club's executive committee, according to the papers in August 1895, expressed his delight that he would be the first member of the Huddersfield Club to fall under the ban of the English Rugby Union, because anybody who was associated with the Northern Union, with the Northern clubs that broke away, was banned for life by the Rugby Football Union, the governing body of rugby, from that moment onwards. So it still remains, however, that it was the case that the development of rugby in the north of England in the late 19th century closely mirrors the rise of the labour movement and class relations in Victorian Britain. And Huddersfield played a key role in rugby dividing along class lines. We just have to look at the dates. The late 1880s were the period of the rebirth of the British labour movement. The famous Bloody Sunday demonstration of November 1887 in London saw police attack a demonstration against unemployment in Trafalgar Square, causing fatal injuries to two protesters, and again the following week when a passerby was attacked and killed by the police. In 1888, women working at Bryanton May's match factory in East London famously went on strike. London gas workers followed suit the following year, and perhaps most importantly, in August 1889, the historic London Dockers strike took place, the victory of which led to the massive growth of what's called new unionism, as unskilled and unorganised workers flocked to join trade unions. And that second half of the 1880s was also a pivotal period in the development of rugby across Britain, and in particular the north of England. So, to go back to its origins, rugby began in the north of England in the 1860s, when middle-class young men returned home from private schools and established clubs to play the newly fashionable game of rugby. For example, the first Leeds club was formed in 1863, the current Hull team in 1865, and Huddersfield Rugby Club emerged from Huddersfield Athletic Club, which was formed in 1864. Rugby was just one of the sports played by the club, and its first rugby match took place in 1886. As with the other rugby clubs in the north, Huddersfield was part of the social and business network of the local middle and upper classes, with the names of heirs to the local businesses, such as Charles Holliday, Charles Brooke and John Crossland, being among the prominent names which would become associated with the club in its first decades. Ernest Woodhead, the second Huddersfield player to win an England cap, later became the mayor of the town. And the key instigator of the rugby club was Harry Beardsall, a local wool merchant, and his efforts instigating the club were rewarded when it recruited over 150 members in its first month. One of the points to emphasise here as well is that this was a club for young men. The idea that women would be involved in rugby, either on the pitch or in the administration, was absolutely unthinkable. In many ways, rugby and football clubs and cricket clubs were set up in the middle of the 19th century as a specifically male domain. And part of the appeal of these clubs were that they were for males only. So women, although they were spectators, never played a role in the game, certainly in rugby, until the First World War. And although I haven't got time to go into it now, it was Huddersfield in the early 1920s where women first got involved in the administration of the game. In the 1860s and early 1870s, players and spectators for rugby came almost exclusively from the middle classes. The Huddersfield Club itself organised a match between Liberals and Conservatives in 1869, for example, with the teams being chosen by prominent local Liberal Edward Brooke and the Tory C.E. Freeman. This match was almost as much a social event as it was a sporting event, and was, according to the Yorkshire Post, attended by nearly all the well-known ladies and gentlemen of the town, while the residents generally evinced an extraordinary enthusiasm for the match. That same year, 3,500 people also attended the match between Huddersfield and Leeds Grammar School. So you get a sense of the social tenor of the club. It was very much part of the local elite and its recreational and social networks. In 1875, the club, Huddersfield Athletic Club, as it was technically known, merged with St John's Cricket Club to form Huddersfield Cricket, Athletic and Football Club. In 1878, the sports ground at Fartown, which you can see here from 1888, which was actually owned by Richard Nutter, who also owned the George Hotel. So there's a very early link there between sport and the George Hotel. Sorry, in 1878, it was altered to make it suitable to play both cricket and rugby. And then later on, as I'll get to, the layout here was shifted as the ground was developed. So it was kind of went from, I think it's going north to north to south here, and it was shifted, so it went east to west. Fartown became not only the home of the club for the next century, but was also one of the most prominent sports ground in Yorkshire and the north. By the time the club had moved to Fartown, there were dozens of clubs playing rugby across Yorkshire and Lancashire. In 1874, the Huddersfield Club was one of the five founder members of what became the Yorkshire Rugby Union. And in 1877, the Yorkshire Rugby Union started the Yorkshire Challenge Cup, which lifted the sport off into another dimension. Its popularity exponentially grew. One of the reasons for this was not just that rugby was very fashionable, not least due to the popularity of Tom Brown's school days, the Harry Potter of its day, but also because, as Dave spoke about, in the 19th century, recreation and leisure actually became part of civic pride. And the Yorkshire Cup meant that now that civic pride, local rivalry, could be expressed on the rugby pitch, because Huddersfield would play Bradford, Leeds would play York, and then even slightly lower down the size of towns, you would get other local towns, Dewsbury playing Batley, Heckman White playing Cleckheaton. The Yorkshire Cup became a focus for local civic pride in a way that few other things at that time could do. And the club itself, Huddersfield itself, became a symbol of the town's civic pride. It was one of a number of buildings and institutions created in the last third of the 19th century, such as the opening of parks and the building of the town hall in 1879, which proclaimed the vigour and wealth of the local middle classes, and which they hopefully demonstrated its superiority over local rivals. The club itself was at the forefront of the great explosion of interest in rugby. It's worth noting at this time that both soccer and rugby were simply called football and seen as variations of the same game, rugby football and association football. It was only in the early 20th century that football became synonymous with soccer. And indeed, outside of Sheffield and Middlesbrough, in West Yorkshire, soccer was a distant second to rugby until the early 1900s, when the first professional soccer sides emerged, one of them being Huddersfield Town in 1908. This is one of the earliest photographs of rugby. It's Huddersfield versus Halifax at Fartown in 1892, and there were 27,000 people there for this match. You can see a line out which was soon abandoned in rugby league. As I mentioned, much of rugby's dominance of the sporting scene was due to the popularity of the Yorkshire Cup, which at this point often attracted bigger crowds than the FA Cup final, and this led to the creation of more and more rugby clubs. These clubs emerged from local communities, from factories, churches and pubs, part of a great explosion of working class interest in rugby. In Huddersfield, this was demonstrated by the start of the Holiday Cup in 1885, a tournament for local teams which was presented by Charles Holiday, the owner of Reed Holiday, the giant dyeing chemical works, and which in its first season had 25 local clubs competing. But the huge popularity of rugby presented a problem to the sports leaders, who were uniformly middle class and privately educated. The new players and fans of the game came from the industrial working class, which had just won the right to the 5.5-day week, which meant that Saturday afternoons were now free for leisure, and whose rising wage levels allowed them a little extra cash for recreational activities, particularly for male recreational activities. Rugby was no longer a weekend recreation for elite young gentlemen. It was now a mass spectator sport, and the leaders of the Rugby Football Union, the game's governing body, felt that their authority and status was coming under threat. Working class players who came into the game did not embrace the ideals of amateurism, in which rugby's leaders had been educated at school and through books like Tom Brown's School Days. Passing a hat around the crowd after a player had scored a hat-trick of tries, or offering players extra money to play for a club, were accepted practices within working class sports. I mean, someone earlier on mentioned Nair and Spell, and Nair and Spell was played for money, as were most sports within working class communities at the time. However, the supporters of amateurism felt, and they were quite explicit about this, that playing for money was prostituting sport for cash. On the pitch, working class players also proved themselves to be the equals and often the superiors to players who had learnt the game at their private school or university. To take one example of the shifting balance of power, when a county championship tournament for rugby began in 1887, Yorkshire won it 7 times out of 8. On the one occasion Yorkshire didn't win, the championship was won by Lancashire. Such reversals on the pitch were seen as a threat to the social hierarchy of rugby, and middle-class players in the north began to leave the game. As the Yorkshire Post asked in 1886, why are so few public schoolmen and clergymen found in our leading teams? It is because they do not care to be hooted and yelled at as part and parcel of a sixpenny show, or to meet and associate with men who care nothing for the game other than as a means to an end. We have nothing to say against the mechanic, the artisan or the labourer, but of course they are, who, as long as they indulge in the game for sport and not for profit, are an ornament to the game. Cup competitions in the Yorkshire Cup had inadvertently helped to dissolve the fabric of rugby's hierarchy. Participation in a knockout cup, as Duncan explained, meant that a club could no longer choose its opponents, and the prospect of defeat by a so-called socially inferior team helped to animate the socially exclusive club's opposition to cup ties. This led to many clubs boycotting cup tournaments or even giving up the sport. So, for example, a series of heavy defeats led to the original Leeds club disbanding in 1883. The rugby school educated leaders of the original Hull FC club gave up the game after a string of crushing losses to what they saw as a lower class Hull White Star team in 1881. The same thing happened to the original York club. And in 1882, Huddersfield declined to enter that year's Yorkshire Cup competition because they were uncomfortable at the thought of possibly playing a team of miners or dockers in a cup tie. The club also boycotted the following season's competition. But such was the power that the Yorkshire Cup now exerted, it was a powerful draw for both players and spectators, and it was difficult for Huddersfield not to play in the cup but still retain sporting or civic credibility, and so Huddersfield returned to the cup competition in 1884. To stem this growing tide of working class influence, in 1886 the Rugby Football Union introduced very rigorous amateur regulations, which banned players from receiving any payments, gifts or incentives. Anyone found guilty of transgressing the rules would be suspended. This ignited a civil war in rugby, at which class was at its heart. It must be candidly stated that the troubles of the rugby union commenced with the advert of the working man player, explained the rugby union president Arthur Budd. However, throughout the late 1880s, dozens of players in Yorkshire were banned from the game after being accused of receiving payments, and clubs were suspended for making payments to players too. There was never any doubt that this draconian regime was directed against the influence of working class players. If working men desire to play football, said future rugby union president Harry Garnett, they should pay for it themselves, as they would have to do with any other pastime. Garnett was a Bradford-based paper manufacturer who shared a similar educational and business background to the leaders of the Huddersfield Club. But it wasn't so easy for leaders of the top clubs to embrace these new strict amateur regulations. The quest for cup and civic glory depended on having the best players, and the best players didn't necessarily come from Huddersfield. So the club had to import them, even if it meant bending the amateur rules by providing them with jobs in the businesses of those who ran the clubs. As early as 1886, the rugby correspondent of the Yorkshireman, the waspish and well-informed weekly, which lit up Yorkshire journalism in the 1880s, if you haven't seen it, I'd highly recommend it, remarked that imported players are the backbone of the Huddersfield team. 2 years later, the Yorkshire Post complained that in Huddersfield and other districts, employers of labour are at present doing infinite injury to the game by finding men employment and paying them excessive wages. And indeed, one would have to have an unshakable belief in the power of coincidence to imagine that the large numbers of Huddersfield players employed at Holidays, Crosslands or Meltham Mills, the proprietors of all of whom all sat on the Huddersfield Committee, was merely serendipity. The influence of the club in the town was such that it could also place players in jobs in town centre pubs, such as its Welsh fullback Billy England and star international three-quarter Jack Dyson, who both worked at Batty's Hotel in Market Walk. Jack Dyson was, I think he was a warehouseman originally, but before he was given an easy job in the pub. And he was also one of the first sporting heroes of the town, so much so, in fact, that after a famous victory in 1889, he had a statue made out of him of butter, and which was put in the front window of a shop to attract shoppers. I assume this is in the middle of winter, because obviously if it's summer, then it's not going to last very long. So whatever moral dilemmas that this may have caused the leaders of the club, there was no doubt in the success of their actions. Huddersfield became one of the dominant rugby clubs in England, regularly attracting crowds in excess of 20,000 and providing players for the English national rugby team, such as Dyson. In 1890, it finally achieved its ultimate goal and won the Yorkshire Cup, defeating Wakefield Trinity 6-3 in the final at Halifax. Success on the field was matched by success off it, and in the same year, the club made so much money that it donated £2,000 to local charities, topping its previous best donation by £800. Such was the strength of its coffers, it was able to spend over £8,500 improving Fartown, and which is where the Fartown that, if you ever went there, when it was in its pomp in the 50s and 60s, that was where the layout and the design and pretty much all of the stands came from, the redevelopment that took place in 1890 and 1891. This huge sum was not merely about providing better facilities for the increasing number of spectators attracted there, but it was also an example of civic rivalry again, and this was expressed in the competition between Bradford, Huddersfield and Leeds for the title of the North's leading rugby arena. So at the same period, Leeds opened the Headingley Stadium, home to both cricket and rugby, and Bradford Park Avenue was also developed into a multi-sport stadium. And again, it was a way that cities competed against each other, towns competed against each other, to demonstrate their superiority in the north of England. But the economics of building a stadium like this also meant that the drive for bigger gates and better facilities clashed with rugby union's amateur regulations, even in the very loosely interpreted form under which it operated in Yorkshire. If a club were to be suspended for violating the amateur rules, a ban on home matches would cut off its cash flow and jeopardise its finances. A ban on star players for receiving money would also damage crowds and hinder its progress on the field. So, to find a way out of the civil war caused by amateurism, Huddersfield joined with other Yorkshire clubs in 1889 to call for the rugby union to relax its amateur regulations and allow players to be reimbursed for the time they had to take off work to play rugby, which became known as broken time payments. The proposal didn't bring peace to rugby. In fact, the intensity of the conflict increased, as rugby union's leaders accused the Yorkshire clubs of trying to introduce professionalism by the back door. Moreover, at this point in the early 1890s, British society as a whole had been plunged into industrial conflict, the like of which hadn't been seen since the days of the Chartists 40 years previously. And rugby became a microcosm of that sharp class conflict. In 1890, cavalry attacked a demonstration supporting striking Leeds gas workers. Later that year, the famous Manningham Mill strike took place at Bradford, where over 5,000 men and women struck for almost 5 months in protest against pay cuts. Famous Bradford players were involved on both sides of the dispute. In 1892, cotton manufacturers in Lancashire locked out their workers, and the following year in Hull, striking dockers were confronted by naval gunboats in the Humber. Rugby's heartland of Cheshire, Lancashire and Yorkshire experienced the UK's highest incident of strike activity in 1892 and 93, culminating in the 1893 miners' strike, where, as I'm sure people here know, troops shot dead two and wounded 16 more strikers at Featherstone. Rugby is absolutely in the middle of that social conflict and increasing hardship. And on a political level, growing working class self-confidence was seen in the growth of the Social Democratic Federation in Lancashire and the formation in Bradford of the ILP in 1893. For the upper and middle classes, their old certainties were disappearing and the fear of the working class was rising. And rugby was a direct participant in these events. Matches were played to raise funds for the Manningham Mill strike in 1891. Hunslet captain Albert Goldthorpe and Castleford captain Harry Speed organised a fundraising match in Leeds for locked out Castleford glass workers in 1893, and the Yorkshire Rugby Union Committee self-debated the 1893 miners' strike when Castleford representative Arthur Hartley called for a donation to the Miners' Relief Committee. Hartley, who incidentally is the great-grandfather of the wife of Paul Carrick, the owner of Leeds Rugby Leeds Club, Hartley was backed by delegates from Hunslet and Bradford, but eventually his motion was voted down by the majority of the committee of the Yorkshire Rugby Union. These heightened class tensions were also manifested within rugby. As working class players and spectators continued to flock into the game, the involvement of former pupils of public schoolboys continued to decline. As one commentator declared regretfully in 1889, this rugby football movement, which commenced in Yorkshire with the classes, first drew its strength from the public schools and the middle classes, has finally, like other movements and fashions, good or bad, spread downwards to the masses. It is this which has led to the corruption of the sport, which has in some districts tended to drive gentlemen out of the sport. Not surprisingly, given such attitudes, friction between the classes flared up in various ways. As early as 1886, Bradford's annual general meeting heard complaints that working class players didn't get a fair chance in the team. At Halifax the following year, working class members of the club complained that they had been barred from the club pavilion. While at Manningham in the same year, a section of the membership ran a working man's candidate for election to the committee. All of these examples highlighted growing working class self-confidence in the sport and the gradual development amongst working class participants of a consciousness that they had contributed as much to the game, if not more, than the middle classes which had hitherto dominated it. This, again, was not to the liking of those who wanted to defend rugby status quo. The rugby game, which, as its name implies, sprang from our public schools, has been developed by our leading London clubs and universities. Why should we hand it over without a struggle to the hordes of working men players who would quickly engulf all others? Asked the cricket and rugby international Frank Mitchell, underlining that this was primarily a class issue rather than a north-south geographical divide. Mitchell himself was a proud Yorkshireman. Writing in the Yorkshire Evening Post, another proponent of broken time payments wrote, If Yorkshiremen cannot afford to play the game they boast so much about, pay them for their services, but let them start a union of their own and indulge in strikes, trade unions, and a general disinclination for honest work so dear to the average North Country working man. As a side note, one would imagine that the centrality of class to this rugby conflict would have caught the attention of the socialist press. But neither Justice, the newspaper of the Social Democratic Federation, nor the Labour leader of the ILP, ever carried any articles on the matter. In fact, the only article on rugby that Justice ever carried was by a member of the Social Democratic Federation who was a member of the Northamptonshire Rugby Football Union, who told readers of Justice that rugby union was the nearest thing to a communistic society that you can imagine, which I don't want to tell you how
how wrong he was about rugby union, how wrong he was about communism. But either way, he was wrong. And in fact, from a slightly later date, as far as I can tell, the Huddersfield-based The Worker never commented on rugby either, despite being in the middle of this. Although Cyril mentioned earlier on that Arthur Gardner, a key figure in the BSP branch in Huddersfield, didn't actually play rugby as a scrum half. The only socialist paper to comment on goings on in rugby was Robert Blatchford's The Clarion, whose sports reporter A.A. Sutherland explicitly called for Northern clubs to break away from the Rugby Football Union over the issue of payments to working class players as early as 1893. Sutherland had no doubt as to why the game was so popular in the North. The prosperity and popularity of rugby dates from the time the working men commenced to interest himself in it, both physically and mentally. His success at the game may not be quite suitable to the taste of the Corinthian, but it is nevertheless a fact that since he poked his nose into the recreation, rugby has come on in leaps and bounds. If Sutherland was the most articulate and clear-sighted of the supporters of working-class clubs, his mirror image was Huddersfield's Reverend Frank Marshall. Marshall was born in 1845, educated at Cambridge and ordained in the Church of England in 1869. He was appointed headmaster of King James Grammar School in Almondbury in 1878. He was, as you might expect of someone given that background, a keen advocate of muscular Christianity, which almost by definition made him a very enthusiastic rugby player and then an administrator. He served on the committee of the Huddersfield Club and in 1890 was elected president of the Yorkshire Rugby Union. For him, rugby was, and these are his words, improving the moral as well as the physical well-being of the working man player. And as such, he was a determined supporter of the rigorous implementation of the Rugby Union's amateur rules. And that meant, in the words of the president of the Rugby Union, Arthur Budd, he would show no mercy but iron rigour against transgressors of amateurism. So it was Marshall who personally directed almost all of more than two dozen investigations into payments to players that were carried out in Yorkshire Rugby. He cross-examined the players at these investigations as if they were in a court of law. In 1891, he unsuccessfully proposed that any player accused of taking payments to play should have to prove his innocence of the charge before being allowed to play the game again. Despite his moral certainty and his high opinion of himself, he was not popular amongst working-class rugby fans. He was heckled by players at after-match dinners, confronted at railway stations by angry supporters, and sometimes stoned by youth as he cycled to and from Almondbury School. He would be a central figure in the tumultuous events of 1893, which would set rugby on its irreversible course towards a split. At the September 1893 annual general meeting of the Rugby Union, the Yorkshire clubs, supported by Lancashire, proposed the legalisation of broken time payments. 5 days before the annual general meeting, the Huddersfield District Rugby Union, made up of the junior, what we call the junior clubs in the area, met to discuss their attitude to the upcoming vote. The delegate from Almondbury School, needless to say a keen supporter of Frank Marshall, spoke against broken time payments. Responding, the delegate from Paddock pointed out that the old Almondburians were in no need of compensation for broken time, as they were not working men. Both sides of the debate organised for their supporters to attend the AGM at the Westminster Palace Hotel in central London. Marshall was one of the key speakers opposing broken time. When he rose to speak, he told the meeting that the aim of the supporters of broken time was to allow Yorkshire clubs to continue to break the amateur rules with impunity and demanded that those who wanted to play players should form their own rugby union. He was roundly heckled by the Yorkshire delegates. Mountebank was a common cry, and the chairman had to tell Wakefield Trinity secretary J.H. Fallis to sit down and shut up. In fact, the debate had little effect on the vote, which was won by the better organised defenders of amateurism by 236 votes to 136. The acrimony of the debate left no one in doubt as to the future of the sport. The Clarion described the speeches of the opponents of broken time as a reassertion of the typical British snob's comfortable belief that the business of the working man is to work. Play was intended only for us gentlemen. For the amateur victors, Pastime, the weekly which had helped gather the proxy votes that helped win the amateur course, gloated that it remains to remove the suspected clubs at the discretion of the RFU committee from membership and expel all those who avowedly sympathise with professionalism. Less than 2 months after the AGM, the rugby union charged Huddersfield with professionalism for allegedly offering Jock Forsyth and George Boak, two players from Cummonsdale Hornets in Cumberland. Forsyth and Boak are offered jobs at Reed Holidays factory as a reward for joining the club. And they're also offered 30 and 25 shillings, respectively, per week for playing for the club. Clearly, both actions were completely outside of the amateur regulations of the rugby union. However, the dispute descended beyond acrimony and almost to the verge of fisticuffs when it was revealed that the person who had tipped off the rugby union about Forsyth and Boak being offered jobs and money was Frank Marshall himself, who was at that point still a member of the Huddersfield committee. As soon as he revealed that, such as the antipathy to him, as you might imagine, he was accused of being a Judas, he resigned from the club and the rugby union undertook an in-depth investigation. This became a major cause celeb, and Huddersfield themselves published a pamphlet on the affair defending their actions. On the evening that the verdict was to be announced, the rugby union's committee of inquiry was meeting in London and the result would be transmitted by telegram up to Huddersfield. Hundreds of people gathered in St George's Square to wait for the telegram bearing the news to arrive. After an acrimonious debate lasting 5.5 hours, both players were banned from playing rugby. The club itself was suspended from playing any matches until the end of 1893 in order to pay £50 costs. Only the votes of the Yorkshire representatives on the RFU committee prevented Huddersfield from being immediately expelled from rugby union. However, if this wasn't bad enough, the consequences for Boak and Forsyth were actually far more serious. Not only lost their jobs at Reed Holiday and the payments that were being guaranteed to them by the club, their previous employer at Cummersdale Mill in Kendal took them to court for leaving employment without giving due notice, which was then a civil offence, for which Boak was ordered to pay £1 damages and Forsyth £3, plus the payment of 50 shillings each in costs, which is a significant blow. Given that Boak was only earning 10 shillings a week and Forsyth £1 a week at the mill, this was a considerable sum. It was now only a matter of time before the inevitable took place and rugby split in two. Following another round of suspensions at the end of 1894, which saw Wigan, Salford and Lee suspended from playing competitive rugby, on the 30th of January 1895, the George Hotel hosted a preliminary meeting of the top Yorkshire and Lancashire sides, who voted to form what they called a sort of mutual protection society to defend themselves against future suspensions by the rugby union. On August the 12th, the rugby union announced that at its AGM in September 1895, it was going to propose that any player or club accused of professionalism would be suspended until they had proved their innocence to the satisfaction of the RFU. A purge was on the cards and the game was almost over. But as the split drew near, Yorkshire's three most elite clubs, Bradford, Leeds and Huddersfield, began to waver. They felt that this was a step into the dark that they were not necessarily prepared to take. However, Bradford's hand was forced by their players, who threatened to strike if they stayed with the rugby union. At Leeds, a special general meeting of all members was held and this voted overwhelmingly to leave the rugby union. And at Huddersfield, the club committee was fearful that they would be unable to generate sufficient revenue to protect the large investment it had made in Fartown if they left the rugby union and were reduced to playing what they saw as minor clubs. And so the club sided with the rebels and blamed the split on the RFU's new laws against professionalism, which they characterised as too drastic in nature and make an apparently small offence magnified into one of the gravest kind. In passing, it's also worth noting that the split, when it took place, also marked the beginning of the end of Huddersfield as the club of the whole town. Rugby league and its clubs over the following 10 years after the split would become a predominantly working class sport. The local middle classes would keep their allegiance to rugby union through the grammar schools and in Huddersfield through the formation of Huddersfield Old Boys Rugby Union Club in 1909, now Huddersfield Rugby Union Club. And the club for all sections of the local community would eventually become Huddersfield Town, not least due to the success of Herbert Chapman and the all-conquering Huddersfield Town side of the 1920s. Town were formed in 1908 and went on to that great success of the 1920s. If you've seen James Mason's fascinating 1972 documentary, Home James, which is on YouTube, you can see how this worked out, because he remarks there that his father, who was born in the 1870s, I think, owed his sporting allegiance to Fartown and Harrow Wagstaff, but James Mason himself had been brought up with Huddersfield Town in the 1920s. It's also interesting, as this plays out, in Brian Jackson's book on working class education, where he highlights the example of a local grammar school, where the boys from a working class background petition the PE staff to play rugby league, because the club only plays rugby union, as was the case with all grammar schools. But the club refused to allow them to play rugby league. And as a compromise, they offered to allow them to play football, because that's a game for everyone. But there was no, and I think this is probably the case today, there was very little, there was no way in which rugby league would be played alongside rugby union, because of the social connotations of class that it carried. And the grammar schools, just like the private schools, remained today, where they exist, bastions of rugby union. I think the other example, which is kind of taken from sort of popular and written culture, is the way that the two clubs are always being referred to. Huddersfield Town, a town, but Huddersfield Rugby League are always referred to as Fartown, almost a district of the town itself. So there's a playing out of the original sense that the club is a representative of all classes of society, which you get in the 1880s, over the 20 years after the split of 1895, where the club becomes seen as predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly the game of the local working classes. And so this narrative is how it came to be that at 6:30 on Thursday, the 29th of August, 1895, 21 of England's leading rugby clubs met just across the railway lines at the George Hotel and voted to form the Northern Rugby Football Union, which today is called the Rugby Football League. So, to return to where I started, the George had only been chosen because of its geographical centrality. But that accident of the railway network should not blind us to the crucial role played in the development of rugby by the Huddersfield Club. So, to end, hurrah for the claret and gold. Thanks very much.